Hi there, I'm Barry Forward, and welcome to the Reboot Forward podcast. This is the podcast where we take a deep dive into the wonderful world of change, reinvention, transformation, and just plain doing something different. In particular, how it impacts the people who go through that change, what they've learned from their journey through change, and ultimately, what has allowed them to reboot forward. My guest today on the podcast is organizational psychologist Jeremy Holt, who over the past 20 years has been focusing on the development of high-performing teams. Jeremy is the founder and CEO of the Center for Team Excellence in the UK. Much of his work centers on the science of teams, social identity, and the role that leaders play in building high-performing teams. Jeremy sees himself as a bridge between the huge body of academic research that has powered much of leadership development as we know it today and the corporations that it serves. Jeremy believes there is a huge shakeup coming to the leadership development industry, and he's more than happy to tell us all about it. Now, here's our conversation with Jeremy Holt.
Well, I think that there's been concern about the leadership development world for, you know, some years. There's been quite a few articles, if you look at things like Harvard Business Review and some of the surveys from McKinsey's, for instance. If you look at the Endelman Trust Barometer, which is done every year and has been done for about 30 years, what you see is that general sort of satisfaction with leaders and trust with leaders has gone down over the last 4 or 5 years, but particularly over the last 2 or 3 years. And CEOs' satisfaction with leadership development has also gone down. And despite it being a multi-billion dollar industry, it doesn't seem to be having the impact that people want. So I think there was already a change in emphasis, and that drives research and trying to just get a different understanding of what's going on. You know, the question has always been, what can I do as a leader to become a leader? And perhaps that's looking at the wrong place. Perhaps where we should be looking at is at our followers and starting to be more inquisitive and more curious about what is it that would make my followers want to follow me? What is it that they're looking for? And if you look in a different place, then you get the chance to find different answers.
So our trust in leaders has gone down. Yeah. Leaders themselves, CEOs, as you said, are kind of losing faith in kind of their ability to kind of embrace leadership development. What's the answer here? I mean, is it going into the work you're doing around teams? I mean, you talk about followers, really embracing this whole concept that the team is the strength.
Yeah, I'm sure there'll be many aspects to the answer. But there's certainly, if you look, so what I try and do is bridge between practitioners who are going out and working with organizations and the academic world. And the academic world can be quite insular. And a lot of the things that are published are in, you know, especially in the areas that I'm interested in, which are to do with social psychology and the psychology of groups. And actually what's going on within someone when they're in a group situation. So what's happening inside their head? So in academic circles, there's actually a huge amount of research about those kinds of processes, but it doesn't really get filtered across into the corporate world very often or very effectively. But when you start looking at it, it really is quite compelling.
When you say looking at group dynamics, what people, it's this whole, and maybe you can explain it a little bit more. It's just this whole idea that when we get into a group, things change.
Yeah, that's right. So really the start point is going right back to the mid-1970s when a guy called Henri Tajfel came up with a theory which was called social identity theory. And it spawned many tens of thousands of pieces of research and improvements to the theorizing. And what the theory was looking at was, why is it that people behave differently in group situations to how they behave in one-to-one situations? So if I'm interacting with you as an individual, and that's all that matters, I'll behave differently to if I'm interacting with you as a representative of a group. And you'll behave differently if you see yourself as a representative of a group. Now, when I say it like that, that seems obvious because we all know that, I don't know, you go and watch your rugby sevens game, you're going to behave very differently to how you would behave if you were in a C-suite with one of your large clients. So we know that we change our behavior in different situations. What social identity approach has tried to do is to understand that process. And what it's really established, I think, pretty conclusively, is that that's a fairly predictable process. So if that is a predictable process and we can understand it, then we can start to influence it. And from a leadership perspective, we can start to think about, well, that thing that's happening to people when they start to assimilate the membership of a group into their self-concept so that it modifies their behavior, if that's something we can understand, then that's something that we can influence. And actually, that's what leadership is about.
So when I'm onboarding a new person into the group, a new employee, just someone who we've set up a committee or something, that's what you're talking about, is how do I embrace them first and then bring them into the fold?
Yeah. So how do I ensure that a team becomes psychologically significant to someone? So of course we know that we organize into teams or work groups for administrative and sort of task reasons. And often we call that a team. But if you ask someone, you know, if I was to ask you now to just reflect on your personal best experience of being in a team, and I was to ask you to think of a specific instance when you were part of a team that felt really, for you was your personal best. Can you think of a team like that? What was your personal best?
Well, it's interesting because I've worked as an independent for a long time, but you look back at there were sports teams that were really good. I was a member, I played team sports in my younger days, and those were really powerful moments. I remember them well, and just where we crystallized, won a championship, right? Yeah. And we brought everybody together, and I can remember everybody's name on that team.
Right. So this is what you find, is that people have an understanding of what it's like to be part of a really good team. Now, whether that's a really high-performing team or not, I can't judge. In fact, sometimes people feel very strongly attached, emotionally attached to teams that weren't particularly high-performing, but they became very emotionally significant to them. The interesting thing about asking that question, and I've asked that question of many thousands of people over the last 10 or 15 years, is how few people say, when I ask what was the team, how few people say it's my current team. So the reality for most of us is we know what it feels like to be part of a really good team. We know the engagement. We know that it's exciting. We know that we work incredibly hard, that we will go beyond the call of duty in order to make it a success. And we know what that feels like. But in our day-to-day lives, that's not what we're experiencing at work. Now, we might be experiencing it more out of work than we are in work. But if you're not really experiencing it in work, then why are we surprised that we don't get the level of engagement, the level of alignment, the level of cooperation and collaboration that we know will have a positive impact on organizations?
There's two parts of that from when I hear that. There's one, the organizational, the leader's role in that, the organization, as well as the individual. So where does that play? I get hired on, or I brought into a group or got a task force or something that we have. What is my role as an individual? And then what is the role of the leader? Is it different, or am I looking at it the right way here?
So there, what the evidence shows us is that there are really two important factors when you're thinking about creating a high-performing team. The first is to establish some shared beliefs. And what the research shows us is that there are five fundamental shared beliefs that, if they're shared within a team and there's agreement amongst the members of the team, will cause those members, will motivate those members to identify with the team. So identify with the team means for the identity of the team to become part of my sense of myself, to become part of my identity. And as humans, what we do is we have multiple social identities. There are many groups that influence us. And sometimes one group will influence us heavily, and at other times it'll be a different group. It will depend on the context and the circumstance. So we have multiple social identities. And what I'm trying to do is make sure that the work team that I'm the leader of is one of those for the members of that team. And that happens by establishing those shared beliefs. So that's the first point, that we need to have an identity that we all agree to. And the second point is that happens through conversation. And so the role of the leader, therefore, becomes someone who initiates conversations that establish shared beliefs that then lead to agreements on what to do and how to do it, that then lead to, you know, ultimately should be driving performance.
And so I'm a young leader coming into this, and I haven't been exposed to kind of this thinking. I just kind of doing it intuitively. I guess that's the kind of the sweet spot for your business would be, is say I have this kind of open ground. Or do you find that people get to a pressure point where they haven't done this and the team is just not functioning well, that they come and say, hey, we need some help?
Yeah, well, it varies a lot depending on the organization. So some organizations are very fixated on the idea of focusing on the individual and not focusing on the group. So leadership development traditionally is about me understanding myself better. And the proposition is, depending on the theories that you are following, that if I as an individual can become, for instance, more emotionally intelligent, if I can become more charismatic, if I can become more visionary, whatever is the theoretical proposition, then people will follow me. So it's about me on my own and then me doing something to other people. And the way that I get to that is through personal reflection.
This concept of executive presence or leadership presence.
Right. And it puts the, you know, and it usually has some statements about what that will look like. So for instance, there's the huge amount of work around emotional intelligence. Or the Jim Collins work of some years ago in Good to Great and Built to Last about steely determination and humility. So they're sort of describing to you certain behaviors that will make you a more effective leader. The difficulty is that there isn't really very much research, good quality research, that shows that that's true. That people aren't really interested in you as you. They're not interested in your personal characteristics. They're interested in you insofar as you're able to help us to be successful. And that's assuming that they have defined themselves as an us. And if they haven't defined themselves as an us, if there is no us, then they're not really interested in you as a leader at all. Now, they might have to do what you tell them because you might be their boss. So, you know, you might have position power. You might have the power to reprimand them. You might have the power to reward and give them recognition. You might have power because you have expertise. You're a subject matter expert. But that sort of relational power, which is what leadership is all about, you won't get unless they can see how you are able to help us.
So it comes down to this whole, the thing that we started out, or you started out with here, was the identity of the group and then communicating it and understanding in it so that I have a general feel of it as a member of that team, and that the leader who's leading us is actually communicating that effectively and embracing it.
Yeah, and because there's been good research in this area, we know that there are certain beliefs that have a big impact on whether people identify with a team or not. And so as a leader, you know, what we can do is we can offer guidance to leaders to know what those beliefs are and how to go about establishing them within a team. So that becomes very practical. So we move away from leadership development being about me as a person, about being a leader, and we move towards leadership development being about doing leadership. What do leaders actually do? And the research gives us quite a lot of clarity around what leaders do. And the interesting thing is it's not what much of the leadership development industry would like you to believe.
Well, explain that a little bit.
Well, the leadership development industry has been built up around an idea of the world which is focused on personality and individual competence. And so what we try and do in organizations generally is we try and break a task down and we try and break a job role down into specific individual competencies. We try and give people individual accountability and individual responsibilities. And we focus on their individual intrapsychic workings, if you like. So what's going on inside their head? And the proposition is if I can understand that better, then I can potentially change that. And that will mean that people will be more likely to follow me. And yet we know that there are many instances of leaders who are highly successful who don't have those qualities. So if you were being a bit more scientific about it, you'd say, well, as soon as I get something that shows that these qualities that I say are essential are not present in someone who's a highly effective leader, then that means that my theory is not correct. You know, it needs to be reviewed a little bit. That's how science works, isn't it? We come up with a hypothesis, and as soon as we see something that disproves the hypothesis, then we have to adapt our hypothesis. We can never prove the hypothesis, but we need to adapt it when it's shown to be false. And that doesn't really happen. And you could make a cynical argument, which is it doesn't happen because there's a huge vested interest in it not being reviewed and us not changing. Because that's how the industry works. But it's pretty hard at the moment. You know, there's some very clear examples of leadership that just don't, very successful leaders that don't fit the mold of what the leadership development industry tells us leaders should do.
And that's, you got some specific examples, I know you do, of individuals, people who are running countries where this has happened.
Yes, I mean, Donald Trump is a very good example. So I don't think that anyone would accuse Donald Trump of having high levels of emotional intelligence. He doesn't come across as a highly reflective individual. I don't think that people would accuse him of being visionary because actually his vision changes very frequently, depending on what the circumstances are. He's much more reactive than he is visionary. I don't think that you'd accuse him of being humble. And interestingly, whether he's charismatic depends on who you are. So charisma is actually something which is attributed to somebody rather than an attribute of somebody. So if you asked his base, is he charismatic? They'd say, yeah, he is, absolutely. If you ask people who are Democrats, is he charismatic? They'd say, absolutely not. You know, there's no charisma in the man at all. So those are things which if you went on a leadership development program, they'd probably sit you down and say, right, we're going to work on your emotional intelligence. It's really important. And yet the most powerful man in the world seems to have very little of it. So how do we explain that? Well, if you start thinking about Donald Trump's success from a social identity perspective, it makes a lot more sense. So what Donald Trump has successfully done, I would argue, is he's built up a story. He's built up a narrative, which is a narrative that is designed, whether it's deliberate or whether it's accidental, I don't know. But what it does is it appeals to a group of American citizens. And these American citizens, you know, in the middle of the country, who need Main Street to prosper, who feel that they've been left behind, who feel that there is an elite which has ignored them, who feel that successive governments and politicians have not represented them. And Donald Trump has come along and portrayed himself as one of us, as a representative of that group, He's going to lock them up. He's going to drain the swamp. He's going to build the wall. And his rhetoric has been very classic of people who are trying to strengthen identity within a particular group. And one of the best ways to strengthen within identity within a group is to create the sense of external threat. And obviously that's very much part of his narrative to create the sense of external threat. So in fact, there's a couple of authors who published a huge amount around this approach to leadership called Steve Reicher and Alex Haslam. Reicher's from St. Andrews University in Scotland, and Haslam's over in Brisbane in Australia. And they wrote an article in the very early stages of Donald Trump's campaign back in 2016, where they did quite a detailed analysis of the language he was using. And they predicted that he would be victorious because he was much more effective at talking about us than Hillary Clinton. We did an analysis which was comparing stump speeches. So leaders who are effective at appealing to a group tend to talk about us and we. They use collective pronouns a lot more than they talk about I and me. And if you do an analysis of Donald Trump's speeches, his stump speeches back in 2016, he used the words us or we. I think it was once every 26 words. In comparison, Hillary Clinton used us or we once every 70 words. So Donald Trump was very much, his agenda was about appealing to us and we. My hunch is, if you were to analyze his speeches now, you would find that that has really dropped away.
Interesting. So when you look back at 2016, it didn't surprise you when you saw this, just based on what those two folks who were looking into it, and just the way we need to embrace the story, the belief. And that's what happened there in that case.
Yes. And I mean, you know, it's always risky to take what you hear from the media and what people say in their speeches as gospel. But you know, for politicians at least, that is all that we get. So it is significant. And what we did back in 2016 before the election was we drew up a template. So we have a model which we use, which is called TRIBE. And what TRIBE is an acronym for the five beliefs that have that motivate people to identify with a group. And so the work that we do with teams, when I'm working directly with teams, is to help them to establish these five so-called TRIBE beliefs. And so TRIBE stands for, the T is for traditions, and traditions is about continuity over time. So that there is a story, there are some beliefs that connect the past, the present, and the future. If you like, a golden thread running through this story. The R is for relevance, so that's about is what we do meaningful? Do we matter? The I is for identity, and that's about what makes us different from other teams. Do we know what gives us an edge? The B is for belonging, and that's about are we committed to clear behaviors that set expectations about what people should do in order to belong to this team, so that I know what's expected of me and how I need to behave in order to belong. And the E is for effectiveness. So do we believe that this team is effective and has the capacity and the capabilities to perform well? So at a corporate level, what I would be doing, or with a sports team or in defense, I've worked quite a lot with the military, I would be helping teams to establish those five beliefs through conversation, guided conversation, so that they're making up their own minds about these five beliefs. And we're looking at convergence towards agreement. So you'll start with people with very different views, and we're converging towards an agreement. And we did an analysis of those five beliefs looking at Donald Trump's story, and it looked like a very complete and compelling story. If you compared it to Hillary Clinton's story, there were just gaps. you know, that there were bits which were not complete from what was in the public domain. So you could see why Trump might be a more effective identity leader than Clinton. Now, obviously, for him to go on to be successful, the size of that group of people who view the world like that needs to be big enough for him to get elected.
When you look at the whole, you've been talking about two things here, the team building, which is, when I hear you kind of outline it like it seems, I would say, obvious. It seems very straightforward. However, it's this bridging between the leadership development work and this development of teams, or the integration of teams into the whole concept. So my question is, are we in for a shakeup in leadership development, bringing along teams with it, or is it something else that is going to happen? Where do you see the future opportunity as someone who's in this leadership development game?
Yeah, I think we already are starting to see a shakeup of it. I think some of the pressures which are resulting from COVID-19 are going to drive some of that change as well. We know that working from home works for some people, and we also know that it creates a lot of stress for other people. And so what it seems to me has happened is that without anyone really discussing it or agreeing it, quite often the psychological contract between employers and staff, employees, has changed. So what that requires is leadership. And I think that if we fall back on the traditional approach to leadership, then we'll find that that's quite a tough journey for us. So what's going to make it difficult for this to change is that people have invested a lot of time and energy in putting together their leadership development programs and their ideas around teams. What this is a paradigm shift, really, and perhaps people are resistant to paradigm shifts. But I think that if, you know, when I look at all the different issues that go on in organizations, the change is overdue. So we talk about organizations becoming too bureaucratic. We want them to become leaner. We want them to become more agile. We used to put people into a team, and within that team, they would work there for probably quite a number of years, and it would be relatively stable, and it would be relatively clearly structured, and therefore over time people could build a sense of identification with that team. But now we're asking people to work in short-term teams that just come together for a very small period of time. Often they'll be cross-functional and multidisciplinary and so on. So we're reorganizing the way in which we structure organizations. And what that means is that people feel less at home. It's less clear where home is to them. So that puts more onus onto leaders in order to create that sense of psychological connection between an organization and the people who work in it by grouping them together into groups that become psychologically significant. And there's some very clear outcome research, which I think, you know, when I go and talk to organizations, this is probably what helps them to decide what they want to do one way or the other. And what the research shows us is, first of all, that teams that have a strong identity outperform teams with weak identities by an enormous margin. So we commissioned some research with the University of Sussex here in the UK. And this research looked at performance and identification across 56 teams. So a decent sample size. And what we found was that if you took the teams that were in the top 25% in terms of their identity, the strength with which people reported that they identified with the team, and compared that with the bottom 25% where people didn't really identify with the team, the performance differences between those two groups was 54%. So the only thing that was varying there was the extent to which people identified with the team. And we're seeing not a marginal gain in performance. We're talking about an absolutely enormous gain in performance by building a stronger identity. So that should be part of the compelling argument. But there's many other research studies as well that shows that there are other benefits that go for this that go with this.
Is there a challenge now with the identity piece that you're talking about, given the movement towards more virtual teams? Is this going to play into it? Is it going to make it more difficult, or is it just another factor?
I think it's another factor. You know, if you don't put in work to maintain connections with your team, within your team, then that team will gradually decay and fall apart. And so, you know, if organizations aren't really thinking seriously about how do they maintain that sense of connectedness and togetherness amongst people who work in their organization, then I think they're doing people a big disservice and probably doing themselves a big disservice. And so, you know, what does that mean? It means being creative with the conversations that you have when you're together as a team, because they won't happen by accident over the water cooler or, you know, over a cup of coffee. It requires managers to be a lot more purposeful, I would say, in having conversations which are about togetherness and connection.
I'm just going to say, if you had a decision maker in front of you, and I'm talking the human resources folks, the leadership development folks who are all embedded across organizations, and they could walk away with one thing from what your research is telling you, what would you be imparting to them right now if you had them on the line?
I would want them to go away and look at the data. I'd want them to look at the information about performance. I'd like them to look at the information about resilience. I'd like them to look at the research that shows that when people strongly identify with a team, that they feel less stressed. They feel more supported. They report feeling higher levels of job satisfaction. So I'd want them to look at the research and look at the data. That would be my key message. And I think if you do that, and it's a bit of a cliche at the moment to follow the science, isn't it? But science is kind of coming back into fashion because we realize that it's really rather important for our survival. And so I really would ask them to follow the science of teams.
So if someone would like to connect with you and chat with you and look at what you're doing and your work, your research, and your sessions that are now virtual, how would they get a hold of you? How would they contact you?
Yeah, so they can contact me by email, and my email address is jeremy@cfte.co.uk. Or they could go and have a look at the website, which is www.cfte.co.uk. And I'm on Twitter as Jeremy J. Holt. So any of those routes, LinkedIn as well, Jeremy J. Holt, Center for Team Excellence.
Well, I want to thank you for taking the time today. We could talk. This is something we could go on for a long time. This is, and I know you have lots of perspective. Is there anything that just, we kind of went down a path here, any thing you'd like to add, kind of conclude with here at the end, Jeremy?
Just that it's been a real pleasure talking to you, Barry. And as you can probably tell, I'm passionate about this subject. It's great to have the opportunity to talk to someone about it, and just the chance to discuss it and stir it up a little bit. And obviously, you know, I'm very happy to have this kind of conversation with other people as well. So if you've got questions about this, or you've got some interest but you're not sure, then get in touch with me, and I really would be very happy to engage with that discussion.
Well, I hope we can do this again, and thank you again, and we will talk very soon.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Barry.
Thanks again to Jeremy Holt for joining me on the podcast. For links to Jeremy's work and the Center for Team Excellence, check out the links in today's show notes. If you have any questions regarding today's podcast or would like to connect with Jeremy or myself, drop me an email at barry@rebootforward.com. That's barry@rebootforward.com. And until next time, let's reboot forward.